In this session from the Montreal Climate Talks in December 2005, Michael Grubb from the UK Carbon Trust applies what they've learned in the UK to the possibility of building a new low-carbon economy for Canada, which is a major oil and gas exporter and one of the highest energy users in the world per capita. What was learned here could be applied to any country in the world.
Welcome to our session on describing a low-carbon future for Canada. What I'd like to do is just introduce to you Michael Grubb, who is going to talk to us about the UK experience, one that's a little further ahead than Canada going down this road. The UK has been implementing a long-term energy strategy titled Our Energy Future, Creating a Low-Carbon Economy. The strategy aims to achieve a 60% reduction in CO2 emissions by 2050. Michael will do something that I think is going to be very helpful to many of us in many other countries who are struggling with these issues. He's going to talk to us a little bit about some of the joys and some of the challenges in practically applying a long-term solution for that significant and important reduction. Michael, we're very honored to have you here, and I would ask you to come take the podium.
Well, merci beaucoup. Thank you very much, Glenn and colleagues, and to all of you here who have, if you like me, had to drag yourself away from a session where one thought we might be getting the opening of the COP1 formally, but hadn't got there at the time, then you had to come here. It's a rather daunting task that I've been set. You refer to the UK experience, and it certainly both has been and remains and will be an extremely interesting and challenging task. I would like to underline that although the institution I now work for half-time, the Carbon Trust, is almost entirely government-funded, it is an independent institution for implementing low-carbon policy and technology development, and my remarks here are in an independent capacity. I would not claim for a moment to be representing the British government position. What I will be doing is offering you some insights, first into why the UK has taken the position it has, second, what are some of the implications, just in terms of my first two opening overheads, and then looking in a bit more depth at the various dimensions of that. Now, do I have a... Yeah, okay, maybe if I take it. So, what I wish to do more specifically... It's probably a little quicker if I looked to my right than my left. To set the context of the stabilization challenge and what it means for, shall we say, a mid-sized industrial economy like the UK, an economy which, incidentally, given the chairman's opening comments, until only a decade or two back was sometimes called an island of coal in a sea of oil and gas. So one of my questions to address is what prompted such a country to try and take a very forward stance on this issue. But I then want to delve a little more into the economics of the energy efficiency side of the equation, and then similarly some observations on supply. Innovation is inescapable. I want to address the question of what does that mean to some degree, and offer some concluding observations on policy and international strategies. Now, you will note that this is going to be more of a sort of economics and policy view on the stabilization or deep, low-carbon economy issue than a technical scenario view. And I know we'll have some of that pertaining to Canada later, on which I'm most definitely not qualified to speak, and also that there is a whole side event put on Saturday afternoon, I believe, put together by Nice and Japan, which has a series of technical scenario analyses. So this is more economics and policy orientation. So let me make a couple of introductory observations. First, as to why a low-carbon economy for the industrialized countries. Well, it's fairly self-evident, but as soon as one looks at the global picture, we're struck by the scale of this challenge and the size of the inequalities. What this graph shows is the per capita emissions as the height of each of these blocks from the different countries and regions in the world, and the width is the population of those different regions. Now, you can see first per capita emissions from the industrialized countries on the left-hand side are typically 5 to 10 times those in developing countries towards the right. The Kyoto Annex 1 is roughly equivalent to the 2 tons per capita or larger group block on the left. You can also see the enormous potential for growth if and as developing countries move towards anything like the per capita levels of others, especially when the global population, i.e. the width of these blocks, is also expanding. So it's a pretty daunting challenge, and I think it didn't actually take very deep analysis for the UK to conclude that if the industrialized countries on the left couldn't get to a low carbon economy, which was implied of at least a 60% reduction from current levels, it was pretty hopeless expecting the world to get anywhere close to stabilizing probably even emissions, let alone concentrations. So it's very much seen as part of the global picture that industrialized countries have to get on this course if there's to be any hope of reining in the global growth. Now, in practice, what does that mean in terms of, if you like, the technical backdrop? Well, what this chart shows is, first, the relationship between the vertical axis, which is carbon emissions per unit of energy delivered, the carbon intensity of supply, and the horizontal axis, which is the energy intensity of the economy, energy per unit GDP. Now, a few things about this. First, on the top right-hand side, you can see a little dot, which is where the UK was in 1990. The dot next to it is where the UK was in the year 2000. In other words, really quite good progress both in decarbonizing energy supply, moving downwards, and de-energizing, so to speak, taking the energy intensity down of the UK economy. Now, that was a rapid rate of change. The UK was a considerable rate of change. But what this chart shows is that if you want to get to somewhere like a 60% reduction, which was the objective of the UK white paper, you have to get somewhere on the curve of the far left of those curves. Technically, it's what we call an isoquant. I just put it up to emphasize that no one in their right minds think that we're going to get to a 60% reduction either purely through energy efficiency, either by moving straight left, or by covering the country with nuclear or wind energy or sequestration, i.e. going straight vertically down and decarbonizing energy supply. A low carbon economy, all of the plausible scenarios that are indicated there involve a healthy mix of the two, and they imply a rate of change sustained for 5 decades, comparable with what the UK achieved during the 1990s. That's not a trivial undertaking by any means. I have put on there a few quotes also from the UK Energy White Paper. And what I would say is that the Energy White Paper published in 2003 was a revolution in UK energy policy. This was not an environmental paper, this was an energy policy paper. It said the central goal of energy policy is to secure a low-carbon economy by mid-century in ways consistent with the other objectives of protecting competitiveness, security of supply, and so forth. And that would require roughly a doubling the average rate of energy efficiency improvements over the past 30 years, a lot of innovation, and that was the final quote on the bottom right, to deliver that would require to provide industry and investors with a clear, stable policy framework. Not a trivial order in the nature of democracy and election cycles. So a few words first about the horizontal axis of that diagram, the energy efficiency side of it. I think arguably the most important single thing to understand about the UK, and one reason it's taken a proactive stance on this, is looking at our last 10 to 15 years, it doesn't look so frightening. The UK economy has been in a very healthy state, and UK emissions have gone down in absolute terms. UK per capita income growth has been almost identical to that in the US and North America, but our emissions have gone down and really quite significantly of carbon dioxide. And that's basically been associated with good news. The rate of improvement was close to 30% during that decade. That's 30% improvement in national energy intensity, carbon intensity. It was associated with removing protection from large industry, some of which was got rather, shall we say, old and inefficient equipment and polluting in other ways as well. Liberalisation of the electricity supply sector. That led to a more diversified supply. It had previously been very coal-based, a dash for gas. None of this was climate policy. More efficient combined cycles and the beginnings of growth of a non-fossil fuel obligation and renewables. The higher economic growth also resulted in more stock turnover, newer leading-edge investments. And then towards the end of the decade, the new government introduced the climate change levy, which has led to improvements in business use of energy that you can measure in the econometric data, and which the macroeconomic modelling studies suggest led to an increase of employment because the money raised was recycled in the form of reduced labour taxes, national insurance taxes. So that kind of left with the UK with the feeling that this carbon agenda is not as frightening as it looks. In terms of going forward, this is a classic technology assessment which shows roughly what the cost of limiting emissions, pounds per ton of carbon dioxide, is from the business and commercial and public sectors. These are the terrains that the Carbon Trust works with. I won't touch on domestic and transport, which is the terrain of the Energy Savings Trust. And the thing to mention just is that these kinds of engineering cost curves always confuse economists because they start out saying there's a bunch of stuff here which is negative cost, tons per carbon. And the obvious question is, well, if it's negative cost, why aren't people doing it anyway? And the answers to that are actually really quite interesting. But one thing I find fascinating is that too many of my economist colleagues seem to say, that negative bit there either can't exist or it's all to do with hidden costs and it's really not interesting. And we're only interested in the stuff that costs us something. Well, I think that's a rather strange attitude for economists to take. I find the potential of doing things which both cut carbon and have a high economic rate of return is very interesting, and that's led into a lot of interesting policy developments. However, it is certainly true that the potential of this, win-win energy efficiency, whilst it is still there and it's still substantial, it's only about 15% or so cutback of emissions, which is where you can see the roughly 8 million tonnes out of about 64 million tonnes of carbon annually coming from these sectors. Beyond that, the costs could start to rise very steeply unless we get innovation. And innovation on the energy efficiency side is probably, the importance of it is somewhat underrated compared with the big sexy stuff of CCS and all sorts of other technologies. But believe me, there's a lot of innovation going on in the UK on energy efficiency. As they see the markets growing, partly because government are beginning to address the barriers and drivers that make energy efficiency tick. Now, I don't want to spend significant time on this. This is more to do with current implementation. I'll have opportunities to say that at the Carbon Trust meeting next week. But just to give you a sense of the kind of analysis underpinning this, if you're looking at what business can do to deliver a low-carbon economy, you need to understand what are the barriers to business doing stuff that looks cost effective and what are the drivers to make it change. And both of those fall into four main camps. You've got your straight investment cost versus energy savings, the classical financial stuff, which is the top line. You've then got hidden costs and hidden benefits, like the employment, corporate social responsibility type benefits. You've then got whole areas where our markets just don't work, like buildings. Tenant-landlord split, absolutely classic case where there are crystal clear economic explanations of why there's a large potential. And finally, a whole bundle of issues surrounding how real organisations behave and the imperfect nature of that and the way you can address that if you get commitment from top-level management. One final word on energy efficiency for the longer term, which is there is a disconnect between national assessments and an international view. If you look at the UK's national assessment, as I showed you, we can squeeze about another 15% out of the UK economy on a still be in the cost-effective area. Then it gets costly. If you look at the elasticity, economists talk about it's, you know, a lot less than one. A 10% rise in energy cost will deliver you a 10% less than 10% energy savings. But if you look internationally, which is what this chart does, it simply plots the energy intensity, which is the horizontal axis, against the energy price in these countries, end-use prices vertically. And an economist would say that data says that elasticity is minus one. To you and I, what that means is countries that have a 10% higher energy price are about 10% more energy efficiency. In more energy efficient results, they don't spend any more on energy. The national expenditure on energy is remarkably insensitive to price. Basically, what goes on is you raise the price, and over a period of a few decades, these countries adjust their infrastructure, their technology, their industrial capacity, and they just become more efficient. And they don't end up spending more on energy. That has some quite powerful implications, we believe. A few words on the supply side. Different countries have different options. What it looks like from the UK will not be how it looks to Canada, to others. But in the UK, we have an emergent debate about supply options for electricity, and I just thought it would be useful to flag this, that for the UK, we're fortunate. We have several potential large zero-carbon resources. Even if you feel gas is too limited and will be and so forth, we potentially have nuclear, we have carbon capture and sequestration, and we have marine renewables, and particularly offshore wind. Even if you think onshore wind will be too constrained by opposition on grounds of visual impact, offshore, it's hard to see fundamental grounds for refusing to develop a little square like the one shown there, obviously actually spread a lot more around and a lot closer to shore. But, you know, when one looks, one finds options. The economics of low-carbon electricity supply at scale, I think, is very interesting because none of the big three options that the UK has will happen without government involvement. Essentially, on all of them, the risks are too big for the private sector to be willing to step into what is ultimately product selling into a regulated market of electricity. And so the government has serious thinking to do. But there are options, and there are very, very credible scenarios for getting to extremely low carbon electricity supplies in the UK. Transport is tougher. I wouldn't hide from that. But most scenarios I've seen suggest that a low carbon transport system is very likely to hinge on first getting a low carbon electricity system. And that is at the moment where the UK is really pushing. And just to underline the theme of different horses for courses, if one is looking at tropical countries, obviously the options are going to be different. But an example here again, and I'm puzzled sometimes at the debates. It's like people are still ever so slightly embarrassed to talk about big scale renewables. Renewables are potentially very big scale. The resources are perfectly comparable with coal in China and so forth and so forth. It's just a question of which directions do we really think we can innovate in effectively. If you'll pardon one other slide of economies, I put this in to show that these policies too can be subject to a kind of cost-benefit approach to how we think about them. Essentially, all of the big low or zero carbon electricity sources, excepting Canadian hydroelectricity, of course, are currently more costly than coal or gas. And therefore, government is going to have to invest to buy down the cost of these industries, to build up the scale of these industries, which is sort of the grey shaded area. A lot of economic evidence on how the costs come down as a scale of investment. And what we see there is the solid red line is essentially the cost of fossil fuel competition. It may well also be coming down slowly with technological progress. But the younger industries, if there's sufficient investment, are likely to catch up and cross. The point at which they cross is going to depend upon whether you are operating with or without carbon pricing of some description, carbon cap and trade or carbon taxes, which brings you to the dotted red line. The more the carbon price rises over time, the quicker the point at which the other technologies become economic. And that, I think, would be particularly true for carbon capture sequestration, which is almost by definition going to involve some additional cost over and above the non-carbon way of doing the same technology. So I always find the sort of debate about carbon caps versus technology is extremely strange. I can't see one happening without the other. That brings me to the final bit of my talk, where I thought it would be interesting to just summarize, so to say, our view at the Carbon Trust of effective low-carbon technology innovation policy. This actually came from a short article that Tom DeLay and I wrote in the Financial Times. Tom DeLay, Chief Executive of the Carbon Trust, not the more famous namesake in Washington, I should say. Five principles for innovation policy. First, learn from history. We have had a history of big government R&D programs swallowing billions of dollars and delivering nothing to market in the energy sector. Before we throw too much more money in that direction, let's be clear about why that was, what went wrong, and how we make sure it doesn't go wrong in the future. I think one of the conclusions from that is that most of the deployed technologies matured in the private sector, so you need to understand the role of business. So business innovation is an ongoing, continuous process. It is not some far-out idea for a few decades ahead. It builds upon what they're doing, it draws from innovation in other sectors, etc. Third, national emission targets are sort of useful. They give industry a sense of where things might be going, but actually if you really want them to be worth anything, the value has to be made bankable through something like a cap and trade legislation. Company has to be able to say to the board, it is worth investing £1 billion in this because this will be the payoff under a cap and trade system. Fourth, cap and trade, whilst useful, is not sufficient to get the scale of innovation required. The innovation chain from idea to product, commercial industry, is long, complicated, risky, and there are a lot of things in the middle that governments can do to accelerate technologies through that process, through a whole range of joint ventures and market-based innovation and industry building programs. And fifth, addressing the global picture, the engine of large-scale industrial innovation still resides in a handful of major industrial powers. If we want to see a global low-carbon economy by mid-century, that is going to have to involve deepening carbon control policy in those major industrial powerhouses such that they develop the technology-based industries that will also, through foreign direct investment, help to diffuse those technologies globally. Now, that is what I would call a business-oriented view of the low-carbon technology challenge. So, just to flesh out, carbon caps, carbon cap and trade, carbon taxes, on their own are unlikely to deliver the scale of innovation required for the reasons I sketched there, the complexities of energy systems, the length and risk of the innovation chain. And the fact that also industries tend not to understand what political processes like the COP/MOP are really delivering or may deliver down the line. But they are certainly a crucial element. So again, it's an issue of necessary but not sufficient. Carbon caps and prices are needed first to deter locking ourselves deeper into carbon-intensive systems. The world, according to the International Energy Agency, will spend about $16 trillion over the next few decades in energy provision. Under the current structure incentives, most of that money will go into carbon-intensive capital stock. It will go into effectively locking us in and learning how to make the climate problem worse by learning how to do carbon-intensive energy more cheaply. So deterrence of such investment, accelerated diffusion of low-carbon technologies, influencing particularly the strategic multinationals, and actually guiding governments themselves also. And as I said, to provide some sense of convergence with low-carbon innovation policies. I think the role of what I'd call innovation chain policies are to accelerate the whole the process of diffusion of technologies or emergence of technology industries through that chain to the point where they can then take advantage of the economic incentives of cap and trade systems. So, since we're here at COPMOP, a final word on international strategies. I do think that the sequentially negotiated cap and trade has got some fundamental elements that have to be there in any effective international regime. But I think it's a mistake to think of Kyoto as a pure cap and trade agreement, as an economist might see it. It's actually something that incentivizes governments to actually implement domestic cap and trade or carbon pricing, but to do a whole lot of other things as well. And I didn't have time to go into the full depth about the various components. And I think it still needs to be complemented by a range of other policy measures related to technology. For some of those, I think there is certainly a case for international cooperation. It remains to me unclear exactly how much of the technology agenda needs to be done through multilateral agreements, but certainly some of it could benefit from it. Well, that's really what I wanted to cover in the way of a sort of economic and policy view on the low carbon deep reductions. I just wanted to add that from a UK perspective, we have already begun on this journey, and there's a couple of other opportunities that I'll have to flesh out a little bit more depth what the UK is doing in terms of implementation and some of the industrial elements of the European trading system. I thought I'd just flag those up. Sorry, it's not there on the French version. And as I say, for those that are wanting more scenario depth, there is additional meetings later in the week as well. I've probably overspilled my time, for which apologies, but I hope that's covered some useful ground.